From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Jules Shear has earned a reputation as one of the best rock songwriters around. Although his own records haven't become hits, Cyndi Lauper and the Bangles have had hits of his songs. On this edition of Fresh Air, Jules Shear performs some of his songs for us. All of Spike Lee's movies have been shot by cinematographer Ernest Dickerson. Coming up, we talk with Dickerson about making his directing debut with the new movie Juice. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the quiz show scandal, part of Public TV's documentary series, The American Experience. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The United Nations Security Council today strongly condemned Israel's decision to deport 12 Palestinian activists. The resolution had full backing from the United States and the other 14 members of the council. The Security Council urged Israel to refrain from such action and asked the country to ensure the safe return of those Palestinians who have already been deported. The measure was tougher than previous drafts. It deplored Israel's earlier expulsion of 66 Palestinians since the start of the four-year Palestinian uprising. United Nations Secretary General Boutros Ghali has announced he's sending 50 military observers to Croatia to help maintain the latest ceasefire. Pierre Vickery reports the decision is being welcomed by three of the main warring factions, but it's drawing criticism from Serbian paramilitary leaders fighting in Croatia.
Dr. Ghali's decision is the first step in a plan to deploy 10,000 United Nations troops in crisis regions of the former territory of Yugoslavia. The advance team of UN military observers would join several hundred European community monitors who've reportedly agreed to go into the most sensitive areas. However, the Secretary-General said he would delay sending a larger force until he obtains guarantees from all the warring factions that they will support the UN peace plan. Serbian leaders in the self-declared Republic of Krajina in Croatia have bitterly criticized the UN proposals, accusing the Serbian government in Belgrade of betrayal. Krajina paramilitary leaders say they'll take steps to prevent foreign troops from entering territory under their control. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
A report released today in France reveals that top Catholic Church members helped shelter a French war criminal for decades. Paul Touvier was hidden by the Catholic leaders for over 40 years until he was finally arrested in 1989. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Paul Touvier was the head of a French pro-Nazi police force in Lyon in eastern France during World War II. In 1947, he was tried for war crimes and was sentenced to death in absentia. When he was arrested in 1989, he was found in an arch-conservative monastery in southern France. Although it was known that Touvier had been helped by Catholic fundamentalists, the report shows that he was also aided by top churchmen with more liberal views. The report says that they sheltered him, gave him money, and asked the state for a pardon on his behalf. The Archbishop of Lyon, which ordered the investigation, said that he was saddened that so many churchmen had put charity before justice. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
The European newspaper, the English Language Weekly, founded by late publisher Robert Maxwell, has been sold. Two British investors have purchased it for an undisclosed price. Stocks closed mixed on Wall Street today. The Dow lost just over a point to end the day at 3,200.13. Advances led declines in heavy trading. This is NPR. There was a major storm in California over the weekend, the fourth in about a week. It was welcome in a state that's suffering through a sixth year of drought. NPR's Ina Jaffe reports.
About an inch and a quarter of rain fell in downtown Los Angeles yesterday, pushing the total rainfall for the season up over 5 inches, the first time the area's had more than normal rainfall in 6 years. San Francisco also got a good soaking, receiving more than an inch. There was also heavy snow in the Sierra Nevada, though the snowpack level there was still below normal. Snowfall in the northern mountains is important to all of California, since it's runoff from those peaks that fills the reservoirs that supply water to most of the state. Weather experts say that the heavy rain and snow over the past couple of weeks does not mean an end to the drought. The state's water supply has been so depleted by 6 dry years that it would take normal or above normal precipitation for as many as 4 years to replenish it. I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
Police in India report that two bombs went off in the state of Punjab today, killing at least two people and wounding nine. The explosions came shortly after the Indian government announced Punjab elections. The balloting will be held by mid-February in the northern state, despite misgivings expressed by opposition parties. Punjab has been ruled by an appointed governor since May 1987. That's when the elected state government was dismissed for failing to control the Sikh insurgency. The International Monetary Fund says it will loan about $60 million to El Salvador to help that country strengthen its economy after 12 years of civil war. The credits are aimed at spurring other donors and creditors into pledging some money of their own. The civil war drew closer to an end last week when the two sides agreed to a United Nations-sponsored peace plan. A ceasefire is scheduled to take effect on February 1st. The government in San Salvador says it needs almost $2 billion to rebuild the country. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Different people know songwriter and singer Jules Shear through his different identities. Some people know him best for the songs he wrote, which other singers made into hits, like Cyndi Lauper's recording of All Through the Night and the Bangles' recording If She Knew What She Wants. Some people know him best from his early days as a performer with his band Jules and the Polar Bears. Others know Shear as the co-creator and first host of the MTV series Unplugged, in which rock musicians played acoustic sets. We invited Jules Shear to unplug and bring his acoustic guitar to our studios and play a couple of old and new songs. Shear has a new album called The Great Puzzle, which will be released on Polydor at the end of the month. I asked him if he started off playing acoustic guitar or if he was more into electric guitar and a produced sound.
I always played acoustic guitar because that was all I had. You know, I had my brother's guitar, and that's what I had to work with, until I moved to Los Angeles and joined the band in Los Angeles. That was when I got my first electric guitar. I didn't have one. I didn't play in garage bands, and I didn't feel like I played guitar. I played guitar so weirdly, which people listening can't see, but I play guitar in a very strange way. And I was also very shy about that, and I always thought, oh, I could never play with the real guys, so I never tried to be in a band or anything like that.
Let's describe this weird way of guitar playing that you're alluding to. Most people, when they play guitar, they fret with all their fingers of their left hand, and you just use your thumb as if it were a bottleneck or something, sliding it up and down.
Yeah, basically what I did was I took my brother's guitar, and I tuned it to an open chord because I didn't know how to play guitar. And I thought, well, there's a chord. That sounds like a chord to me. And then I thought, well, if I just go up and down the neck, there's a whole bunch of chords. And this whole world opened up to me. And I thought, well, I want to write songs. Look, I have all these chords at my disposal now to write songs with. They were all major chords because it was just a major strum going up and down. It was like a G chord. I didn't know it was a G chord at the time, but that's where it ended up being. So I just found all those chords. And for the first, 3 years of writing songs, I wrote all songs with major chords because that was all I had to use. And then I had this major light bulb went off in my head when I found how I could play a minor chord as well. And then I had all the majors and minors, and then that opened up a whole new world of songwriting for me where I could use minor chords. So then I had all the majors and minors, and that was it. That's how I started. That's the only way I've worked. I mean, I thought about... After that, I thought, I could really learn to play like normal guys play, you know. But then I thought, maybe it's something to do with the way I see the guitar neck or something that makes me play certain chord changes. Or maybe it has an influence on my songwriting that I don't want to mess with. So I just always played the same way. And now I'm kind of glad I play this way.
I want to ask you to start with a song from your new record.
Yeah, I'd love to.
Maybe you could do Dreams Dissolve in Tears.
Yeah, I'd like to do that. That's good. This is a song that on the record is a duet with a songwriter that I've worked with a lot. And we wrote this song together. And then a couple months ago, we got married.
That's nice.
Isn't that a sweet story?
She met him, he was always saying goodbye. Never with his voice, but with his touch and with his eyes. It was easy plans that neither meant. Not to deceive or with plans to leave, it was pure without intent. Salt dissolves in water, youth dissolves in years, but it's the harnessed fade to watch the way that dreams dissolve in tears. Their dream started with a single in the village, which she liked cause she could see the trees. But he got in bad trouble that drove them all the way to Albany. He watched in front of them, but he watched behind his back. That far from the city lights, night got pretty black. Salt dissolves in water, youth dissolves in years, but it's the hardest fate to watch the way that dreams dissolve in tears. Started banging on the wall. It was some terrible song she could remember loving. Now she couldn't stand that song at all. He couldn't turn his luck around with the contacts at his local. Destruction got too easy, thinking got too hard. And of course she was crying again, one night out of two. And he'd say, there's always somebody crying somewhere. Tonight I guess it's you. Dissolves in water, youth dissolves in years, but it's the hardest fate to watch the way that dreams dissolve in tears. Salt dissolves in water, youth dissolves in years, but it's the hardest fate to watch the way dissolve in tears.
Great song. Performed for us by Jules Shear. And that song's on his new record, The Great Puzzle, which is coming out at the end of the month. Where did that song start? What was the phrase that you came up with first?
I think it was the idea of, talk about biographical songs,
yeah.
Not autobiographical ones. This was a song that was really like based on two friends of ours who have had a really rough time and moved around a lot. And when the record was done, this friend of mine lives pretty close to me, so he really wanted to hear the record, and I felt really weird about playing him the record.
Oh, because it's about him.
Yeah, and I thought, well, he wants to hear it, so I'll take him the record. So we played it, and the song happens to be eighth on the record out of 11 songs. So I had to sit there through the whole record going, it's coming, and he's going to hear it. And we listened all the way, we're going through the record, and then it gets to that song, and then the song plays all the way through, and at the end, I just waited for him to say something, and he said nothing, just went on to the next song. And I thought, isn't that weird that you could sit there with somebody, and the song is about him, and he's sitting there listening to it, and he doesn't even know that it's about him. And when the whole record was over, he said, God, the record was really great. I loved it. I'm really happy for you. now can I hear the song about me again?
Oh. Yeah. So
he knew. He just shut up about it, but he knew. He knew it was about him immediately. And now he just calls it the song about him.
Well, if you're just joining us, my guest is Jules Scheer, and we're going to talk some more, and he'll play another song after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. With Jules Scheer, and he has his guitar with him. By the way, he has a new album called The Great Puzzle. Now, I want to get back to something we were talking about before, which is how kind of quiet and shy you were when you started to perform. What was it like when you first got on stage? And there you were in front of a lot of people having to be very public.
Yeah, well, I had to really I made a great effort, you know, to come out of myself and do it. I mean, you know, I grew up in a neighborhood where people didn't do this kind of work. You know?
What kind of neighborhood was it?
Well, you know, people worked in, you know, not everybody worked in the steel mills, but a lot of people worked in places that depended upon the steel mills. It was a real working class sort of neighborhood. It's a great neighborhood. I mean, I go back there now because my parents live there. It's a great neighborhood, but it's really like, you know, there probably aren't too many songwriters that have come off that street where I grew up. I mean, people just didn't do it. And if you told people you wanted to do it, they, you know, they would just think, well, that doesn't happen to people from here, you know. So I just thought I took my shot at it, but I can't say that I got like a lot of encouragement.
You strike me as someone who knows a lot of songs, and probably songs that a lot of listeners might think of as being worthless or cliched. You probably really love or find something within it that you love.
Yeah.
Can I ask you to just like redeem a song for us? Redeem a fragment of a song.
A song
that's generally despised or not thought well of that you think is really wonderful.
How about a song by Brenda Lee? Would that be something you would be looking for? Something
you might
like
not
that?
Need redemption. It might already be redeemed.
It is a great song, but it's not something where someone says, gee, Jules is going to do a Brenda Lee song, you know. I heard recently, I thought it was a great song that I've kind of been playing. I don't know if I could remember all the words.
Yeah, that's okay. Do what you can with it.
All alone am I. Ever since your goodbye, all alone with just the beat of my heart, people all around, but I don't hear a sound, just a lonesome beating of my heart. Other hands, when I'd be holding only emptiness. No use in kissing other lips, when I'd be thinking just of your caress. All alone am I, ever since your goodbye, all alone with just the beat of my heart, people all around, but I don't hear a sound, just a lonesome beat of my heart. That's a great song.
It is a great song.
You know, I don't know. It's just like a song like I heard when I was a kid, and then I just heard it recently and went, wow, what a cool song. And like when I was a kid, I just remember thinking, oh, that's good. But it's like nothing I would ever bother to learn because you'd never think, gee, I'll go upstairs and learn a new Brenda Lee song. I just wouldn't do it, you know. So, but then when you actually slow it down, she does it pretty slow. But then when you do it without all like the orchestration and everything, it just is like a really... really nice sort of 50s kind of thing.
Oh, yeah, it's really lovely the way you did it. You did it in this really small voice, too. Brenda Lee's more of a belter in a way.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Thanks.
Mostly, you sing your own songs, and a lot of other people have recorded your songs as well. Who have you been writing for lately?
Well, you know, I wrote a bunch of songs with the guys in the band.
Uh-huh. In the band on the new record.
The band. It's confusing when you talk about
that. I should mention, you're living part of the time in Woodstock, where the band, members of the band live. Yeah,
yeah, and it was right after I started renting this little house there where I got this call about that they wanted to do a record. And I went up there and had a fantastic time. We had a place rented, and we would just go there every day and work on songs.
What's your approach to polishing a song when you've written a song? What do you do to polish it? How long do you work on it before you actually go into the studio and start producing it?
I work a lot longer on songs now than I ever did. I write less songs now than I used to, and I work harder on each one.
Mm-hmm.
I think when I was younger, I used to write a lot of songs, and I didn't really work for a long time on any of them. I just wanted to get the next one out. And it seems like as I get older, I want each one to be... really, really as good as it can be. And maybe it's also now that before when I was younger, I didn't trust myself to know when I was going to start making it worse again by working on it longer. But now I actually have the belief in myself, I suppose, to feel that like I'm going to keep making it better and to know when it's actually at the point where I'm not. I don't think I believed that I knew that before. And I think... now that I do, I can work on songs longer and enjoy it for a longer period of time. It's worth it if you, in the end, if I can sing a song and not have any of what I call bumps in the song where I go, I don't really like this part. Here comes that little part that I don't really like that much again. You know, if I can go through a song and not have any of those little things, then it just makes life with that song, living with that song from now on, so much better. It's as with many things in life, it's better to put in the work at the time and enjoy it later rather than let it go and have it always bother you.
Jules, can I ask you to do another song for us, and can I make a request?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
can you?
Do I know it?
Yeah, yeah. It's one of yours. It's called Whispering Your Name.
Oh, yeah.
This has a great build in it. I really like it.
Keeps simple thing. I try not to pretend. If it's just for jealousy, she's using me. That might be hard to mend. Oh, what else can I do but try to give her more than she got from you? And when she wakes up suddenly and she says your name to me, I just hope it's force of habit and not need. 'Cause she keeps whispering your name. She keeps on whispering your name like she's just waiting. Tell me what is fair when nothing's wrong and she just stares like she's just
song. How long did it take you to write that one? That seems like a song that's really perfectly polished. I mean, it seems like that's a song, yeah. song that wouldn't have those kinds of bumps that you were describing.
No, it didn't. And it did. That's right. And it did come pretty quickly, that song.
Did it?
Yeah. It was very much inspired by Roy Orbison, you know.
I could see that because it has that kind of build that a lot of his songs.
Yeah. Right? It was actually the song, you know, I'd heard the song on the radio when I was with my friend, when I lived in Boston, I met this guy, Elliot Easton, who played guitar in the Cars. And we would ride around a lot and listen to the radio. And we heard this oldie station. There was this song by Roy Orbison. And we didn't know, we had never heard the song before. And, you know, we thought between the two of us, we knew all of Roy Orbison's hits. So it was really unusual. We didn't know the song. And so we spent a lot of the day going around to record stores looking for the song that we heard on the radio. We had the title and everything, but we couldn't find it. But that's what inspired me to go, God, I want to write something that kind of has that Orbison-like quality. You know?
But he has such an incredible range. Was it hard to write that for your voice?
Yeah, with my tiny range, is that what you're implying?
Well, I mean, who has the range of Roy Orbison?
No, that's true. I just wanted it to be powerful. I didn't really think about it too much. And then when we cut it, I cut it with Todd Rundgren, and we had cellists come in, you know, and do this thing on it. And it was really fun. It was really a good experience. We thought it would actually, might even be a single, but it never was.
Well, I wish you the best with the new record and with your upcoming performances and so on. It's really been so much fun to have you here. Thanks
Great.
A lot
Thanks.
For playing for us.
We
really appreciate
it. You make it very
it.
Easy. I appreciate that.
Thanks. My guest has been Jules Scheer, and he has a new record, and it's coming out at the end of the month. It's called The Great Puzzle, and it's on Polygram Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air, and let's close out with some music from the new album by Jules Scheer.
She's a jewel in a cobweb. He thought that he could hide her. And once you get to know him, he's quite an ugly spider. So everybody wonders why this pretty little gem just doesn't leave.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Cinematographer Ernest Dickerson has shot every Spike Lee film. But before he made a career for himself as a cinematographer, he was writing a script which he hoped to direct. That story has finally made it onto the screen. Coming up, Dickerson tells us about making his directing debut with the new film Juice. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews a new documentary about the quiz show scandals of the 50s. It will be shown on public TV series The American Experience. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. With full U.S. backing, the U.N. Security Council has strongly condemned a plan by Israel to deport 12 Palestinians. U.S. officials have been concerned that the Israeli move might damage peace talks scheduled to resume in Washington tomorrow. Arab delegations have delayed sending their diplomatic teams to Washington in protest of the Israeli deportation move. Barry Schweid has more.
The stalemate should be over once the U.N. Security Council, with the support of the Bush administration, deplores Israel's order expelling a dozen Palestinians on suspicion of promoting terrorism. But the bad feelings may linger. The U.S., once again, has split with Israel over a Palestinian issue, and the Palestinians are accusing Israel of creating a climate of suspicion with the expulsion order. Four Israelis have been killed in the last 10 weeks in the territories, but the State Department says deportations are not the answer, that Israel should bring its evidence into a courtroom and conduct a fair trial. There is no sense of crisis at the State Department, however. Officials are meeting with Israelis and Palestinians, and rooms have been set aside for the negotiations once the Arabs join the Israeli delegation already in Washington. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
And the State Department says that the U.S. will not have closer relations with any government in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia that does not show respect for human rights. President Gamsakhourdia fled Georgia after a two-week standoff with rebels who accused him of trying to create a dictatorship. He had denied the charge, but as Washington Post reporter Jim Rupert says, the Georgian leader has been losing support.
Gamsakhourdia, in the past couple of weeks, has kept a hard line all the way along. But over the past few days, he's been losing key supporters, even for example, his foreign minister, who a couple of days ago left his side and went over to the camp of those calling for his resignation. And basically, I think the sense is that he felt his position had just become untenable. He was losing not only officials from amongst his ranks, but also numbers of fighters there to defend him in the parliament building.
Jim Rupert of the Washington Post in Tbilisi. U.S. officials say the flow of boat people from Haiti to the United States appears to be easing. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher says that the U.S. Coast Guard has not picked up any new Haitians at sea in a week now. Before that, more than 8,000 Haitians had been picked up in 3 months' time. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 1 point to close at 3,200.13 on volume of some 225 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 5-4. This is NPR News. During evening rush hour, a power failure hit Washington, D.C., tying up traffic and darkening buildings in much of the downtown area. Police officers were sent to direct traffic at intersections jammed with homebound commuters, and firemen were sent to buildings where people had been trapped in elevators. Some of the federal buildings hit with the power outage were the State Department and the Securities and Exchange Commission. Power company officials say they don't know what caused the problem. The Algerian prime minister has accused certain parties of not playing fair in the first round of the country's general elections. In the first round, the fundamentalist Islamic Salvation Front won many available seats but fell short of an overall majority. Alf Hermida reports from Algiers.
Algeria's prime minister, Sid Ahmed Hazali, has admitted that the country's first multi-party general elections were not, after all, free and fair. He said that while the government had fulfilled its commitment to holding free elections, other parties had interfered with the ballot. The country's highest judicial body, the Constitutional Council, is investigating more than 300 allegations of electoral irregularities. Most of the complaints are directed against the fundamentalist Islamic Salvation Front. Amongst the allegations, party militants are accused of dressing up in black robes and veils and voting several times with polling cards belonging to illiterate women. The Islamic Party says the allegations are unfounded. If any of the complaints are upheld, the council could reorder a rerun of the ballot. For National Public Radio, this is Alf Hamida in Algiers.
German officials concerned over reports that aid intended for Russian citizens has been showing up on the black market are sending in a special team to help ensure compliance. A German newspaper reported over the weekend that a considerable portion of German aid for Russians is being stolen and then sold on the black market. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Ernest Dickerson, has been the cinematographer on all of Spike Lee's films. In fact, he's now finishing up shooting Spike's movie Malcolm X. But before Dickerson's career as a cinematographer took off, he wrote a script which he hoped to direct. Now, 8 years later, he's making his directorial debut with a revised version of that script. The movie is called Juice. Juice is a slang word for respect. The story is about four young men coming of age in Harlem, doing what they can to get respect. One of the boys, Q, is a hip-hop DJ who has placed in a competition. But the three other members of his crew think their best chance of getting money and respect is through crime, and they drag a reluctant Q into the deal.
Some of Q's attitudes, I think, were some of mine when I was his age. I grew up in Newark, New Jersey, grew up in the projects of Newark, New Jersey. And, you know, I had my friends that I hung out with all the time. And after a while, when I was about 16, I started to, pursue things that were away from them. Even though they were still my friends, I started to do my own thing. And I think there was a little bit of resentment on that fact. I never got involved in any crimes or anything, but just the idea that eventually after a while, a kid starts to pull away from his friends that he knows best, that was something I wanted to add to my script. Of course, in the case of Q, he gets pulled back.
Did you have any friends who got into crime themselves as you were pulling away?
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people that I grew up with who are no longer with us, are either dead or in jail or just burnt out.
One of the issues for the characters in the film is how do you earn respect in a neighborhood where everybody's very tough and anybody who's vulnerable is going to become a victim. Was that a big issue for you, how to make a name for yourself or, you know, how to get respect in your neighborhood or in the projects?
Yes, it was. But when I was coming up, we're talking about the mid-60s. It didn't have the deadly consequences that it has for a lot of kids today. I think, you know, when I was coming up, you always, and I think when every, you know, young man or young woman comes up, they're always wondering what kind of power do they have to affect their surroundings, you know, what kind of influence do they have in their neighborhood, how are they seen by their peers. You know, everybody wants respect at this point. You know, youngsters are always testing the waters, unfortunately. Some of them get the wrong ideas of what juice or what power and influence really is, and it takes them in the wrong direction.
So this is the first film that you've directed yourself. Why did it happen now? What was right about the timing now to direct it?
Well, there's more films by black filmmakers being made today. I guess black filmmakers are the flavor of the hour in some respects. I don't know if that made it more possible for me to do it now.
Well, there is a dawning awareness in Hollywood that films starring black actors can be profitable. What are some of the ways you've seen Hollywood change in its attitude toward black directors, black actors, movies about black characters?
Well, I think there's still a wait-and-see attitude on Hollywood's part. I don't think we're still going to be allowed to be given the budgets that the white directors are being given nowadays. Case in point, I think, is Malcolm X. Malcolm X is an epic film about one of the most important figures in the mid-20th century, and Warner Brothers had a ceiling on how much money they wanted to spend on the film, which to me was not enough money to really do the film correctly. I think that if Norman Jewison wanted to do the film, and he originally did want to do the film, and Spike lobbied and had the film taken away from him, if Norman Jewison did the film, they would have given him $40, $45, $50 million right off the bat. As a result, we did Malcolm X for $24 million, and I'm sure that we're expected to meet the same artistic criteria and standards that Norman would meet on his films.
Where are you now in the process of making the movie about Malcolm X with Spike Lee?
On January 12th, I'm going to Egypt to shoot the last bit of footage that we have. We have scenes of Malcolm in Egypt when he went over there for his pilgrimage. And also we have to shoot material of his Hajj, the pilgrimage that he made to Mecca.
Let me ask you, there was such a controversy over who should be the director to shoot the biography of Malcolm X. As you said, Norman Jewison was to be the director. Spike Lee said that he thought it should really be a black director. Spike Lee got the job. And then there were some other people who were saying, well, Spike Lee is black, but he shouldn't be the one to direct this because he doesn't really comprehend the history that well. And so he won't do a historically just job. Did you get involved in taking sides on this? You've worked with Spike Lee for such a long time, but what were your thoughts on that part of the controversy?
Well, I mean, you know, Spike was able, though, to get access to information and sources of information that I honestly don't believe Norman Jewison would have been able to get.
What do you have in mind?
And so I think he would have been able to put more truth into the story.
What kinds of
information? I think access to the Nation of Islam,
uh-huh.
to different factions of the Nation of Islam, people that knew Malcolm, people that were probably more comfortable talking to Spike than they would have been talking to Norman. If Norman would have gone after those sources, I don't know if he would have.
You know, people from the Nation of Islam had served as the guards on some of Spike Lee's earlier movies, shooting on location.
Mm-hmm.
And since there's still a mystery surrounding Malcolm X's death, but people from the Nation of Islam have been implicated in it, I assume that you weren't using people from the Nation of Islam to guard the set for Malcolm X?
Yes, we did.
You did?
Mm-hmm. They have a security force. It's mm-hmm. a security force for hire called X-Men.
Did you use them for your film, too, shooting on location in Harlem?
Mm-hmm.
So how does that work? What do they do?
It's an excellent security force. What do? They they make sure that the set is secure, especially when you're shooting in rough neighborhoods. You want to make sure that when your back is turned, that a piece of equipment is still going to be there. But also, we started using X-Men on Do the Right Thing. One of the things that they did was, since that block that was the set for the film was in a very rough neighborhood of Bedford-Stuyvesant, the X-Men actually went in and cleaned out the neighborhood. They closed down several of the of crack houses that were on that block. Also, I think that during the time that that we were shooting on that block, in probably one of the worst sections of Brooklyn, I think we had the safest block because the X-Men were there. One thing about the X-Men is that they do command respect in the black community.
Mm-hmm. Did you run into problems on location in Harlem?
None at all.
Ernest Dickerson,
Other than weather.
Right.
That was the biggest problem. Weather was the big problem. We had no control over that. But the day-to-day shooting, the people in the neighborhood, I think they were very supportive and very good.
Director and cinematographer Ernest Dickerson is my guest. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Ernest Dickerson, who is a cinematographer on all of Spike Lee's films. He's just directed his first feature film, and it's called Juice.
What were some of the greatest frustrations you were up against making Jews?
Weather.
What was wrong? Rain a lot?
Oh, the rain was ridiculous. It would, we'd start out days where the weather report said no chance of rain, sunny all day long, right? And we'd schedule an exterior scene involving a lot of people. And we'd be going along and clipping along nicely and getting everything done. And about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, it started getting darker and darker and darker. Meanwhile, my cinematographer's lens was opening up. He was opening up wider and wider and wider. And then it would pour, you know. So we've got 3/4 of the scene done. And now it's raining, and we can't shoot the rest of it. And this happened several times. It was one night when they said there was no chance of rain. And we're shooting an exterior night scene. Got everything lit up. Started raining, all right? Luckily, I was able to, like, redesign the scene so we could shoot it in a pretty confined setting. We had a tent built over the set. Okay, so broke for dinner at around 1 o'clock in the morning. It stopped raining. Came back from dinner. Started raining again. And we shot it dry, but the thing is the rain made so much noise on the tarps that a lot of the scene had to be looped. And went home and talked to my co-writer, Gerard, about the rain. And he said he was downtown and it didn't rain. And I talked to people that were in Brooklyn and they said it didn't rain in Brooklyn. And it became obvious that it was only raining where we were shooting. So I started taking that personal, you know. That's when it got frustrating.
So one of the problems with all this lousy weather you got is there's probably no room in the budget to schedule in more shooting days to wait for the sunshine to be right.
Nope, there wasn't. No, it was rain or shine. We had to go with it. What you have when you schedule a film, you have what are called cover sets that you try and do most of your exterior scenes first. And if you run into a rainy day, then you have an interior set that's prepared so you can go in there, you know, in case it rains as a cover set. What happened is that Juice is mostly an exterior film. So most of it shot outside on the street, so cover sets had a tendency to disappear kind of quickly. You know?
The leads in your movie are young actors who haven't been in much before. Did you use any unconventional ways of casting, of putting out the word that you were looking for young actors?
Well, when I wrote Juice, even when I wrote it 8 years ago, there weren't any actors that I knew of that were on the scene. You know, no young teenage actors on television or in movies that I knew of that could really bring these characters to life the way I wanted them to. I knew that we would have to have unknowns. A lot of times you have a tendency to see characters that are teenagers in films, but they're played by people that are in their, like, low 20s, you know, like 22-year-old playing a 17-year-old. And for some reason, they always look older to me. I wanted real 16, 17-year-olds. I felt that having that youthful look there would make the tragedy of their situation in the film much more palpable. So what I needed were, like, young 16, 17-year-old kids that could be believably from Harlem, from the streets of Harlem. And so what we did, we went after unknowns. We went to, we contacted community theater groups, high school theater groups, YMCA theater groups, community drama groups, really looking for the young actors. And we interviewed and read hundreds of actors. A lot of them very, very good, but it was just finding the right 4 guys.
I know the first photography job, the first cinematography job you had was working for Howard Medical School. And while you were there, I understand one of the things you had to shoot was amputations. And I was wondering what effect that had on your...
What? You remember that, huh?
Yeah. I was wondering what effect that had to how you shoot or direct violent scenes. You know, what was it like for you to be behind a camera shooting
the real thing. Of course, it was medical. It wasn't violent, but it was very gory.
I think, if anything, when you shoot medical stuff, you know what color red blood really is. So I guess you make sure that that happens. Makes me think of a little story that happened when we were doing Juice. We showed up on a location one day, and trucks pulled up, and there was a body laying on the street. Somebody had been shot right there. And we got there right before the police came. And the police came and took the body away. And I go about setting up the shot. I notice that my prop man is looking at the blood on the street and, you know, trying to, like, really copy the color of it and, you know, see how it mixes with rain and everything else. That's a true story.
Yeah. Wow. So where was the murder or the body?
The body was on a corner that we were going to be shooting on. It was up in, about 165th Street.
Did that shake you up?
Yeah, it's just an interesting way to start the day. We knew it was a rough neighborhood. The neighborhood, that four-block radius that we were shooting in those 3 days. I think I'd heard that neighborhood was responsible for about 60% of the murders that had happened in New York last year. It's a very drug-intensive neighborhood, a lot of drug dealing going on. And my car was broken into while I was there. Yeah.
You didn't have someone from the Nation of Islam protecting the car?
They were there, but, you know, I guess they can't be every place at every time.
Ernest Dickerson directed the new movie, Juice. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what do you have on the president's trip?
Well, we're covering the news of the day, Terry, the president's negotiations with the Japanese, but also Japan bashing and fears of Japan bashing in that country and how that's affecting the way the talks are going. We will be covering the disappearance from Georgia of President Gamzahordia, who has apparently fled south to Armenia. And we have a big feature tonight on Las Vegas and racism. Black entertainers apparently appeared on stage in Las Vegas years before they were able to enjoy the hotels and restaurants as customers.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Tonight on Public TV, The American Experience presents a documentary called The Quiz Show Scandal. It recounts the era in the mid-50s when TV quiz shows shot to prominence and then were shot down when it was revealed that some of them were fixed. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
You want scandal? Here's a scandal. PBS paid me $64,000 to give The American Experience a good review. Only kidding. I don't take bribes. Nobody offers them anyway. And besides, the quiz show scandal is such a good program that bribery wouldn't be necessary. Watching it is reward enough. Producers Julian Cranin and Michael R. Lawrence bring back the excitement, entertainment, and innocence of the mid-50s and lay out their story like a Perry Mason mystery. They interview former talk show hosts, producers, and contestants and show tons of clips from such wholly or partly rigged quiz shows as 21, Lotto, and the most popular TV series of 1956, The $64,000 Question. Like quiz shows themselves, the quiz show scandal is loaded with neat little bits of trivia. Question: what nationally known psychologist rose to prominence as a contestant on the $64,000 question? The answer, which you probably already know, is Dr. Joyce Brothers. But did you know that she was the intended victim of a fix by Revlon, the show's sponsor? Here's how the quiz show scandal, with clips, narration, and interviews with people involved with the show, tells the story.
Is our psychologist from New York City, whose category is boxing, Dr. Joyce Brothers.
And she was very popular, except perhaps with the sponsor.
Doc, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Hal.
I had to face the get rid of her bit.
I'm going on, Hal.
For $16,000.
She didn't fit in with their concept of what cosmetics were all about.
At about $16,000, they thought they would knock her off. And this time, instead of asking her questions about boxers, They asked you a question about referees.
What man refereed the comeback attempt of an ex-champ against Jack Johnson at Reno, Nevada?
Tex Rickard.
You're right!
So she really rode that one to stardom and fame.
The biggest fix of all, though, was when the quiz show called 21 set up a series of confrontations between its reigning champion, Herb Stempel, and challenger Charles Van Doren. The setup was a lot like TV wrestling. Stempel was the unattractive bad guy, the villain you love to hate, and Van Doren was the handsome hero. Both sides were in on the scam, and producer Dan Enright milked the suspense by having the two play a series of ties. Until, when the whole country was caught up in the drama, the outcome was decided in advance. Here's how Stempel recalls the setup.
One of those questions on the final night involved the 1955 Academy Award winner.
Herb Stempel, you have 16 points. The category is movies and movie stars. What motion picture won the Academy Award for 1955?
I knew that the answer was Marty, but Dan Enright specifically wanted me to miss that question. This hurt me very deeply because this was one of my favorite pictures of all times, and I could never forget this. A few seconds before that, as I was trying to come up with the answer, I could have changed my mind. I could have said the answer is Marty instead of On the Waterfront. I would have won. There would have been no Charles Van Doren, no famous celebrity. Charles Van Doren would have gone back to teaching college, and my whole life would have been changed.
On the Waterfront? No, I'm sorry, the answer is Marty.
Van Doren won the battle, but eventually lost the war. Shortly after losing, Herb Stempel blew the whistle, but nobody believed him. It took years, and in the best mystery story tradition, a surprise witness and a smoking gun clue, before the truth was brought out and Van Doren and company were brought down.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. He reviewed the quiz show scandal, which airs tonight on the public TV series The American Experience. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis and Richard Parker. Roberta Shurrock directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Doc Pomus co-wrote such rock and roll classics as This Magic Moment, Save the Last Dance for Me, Teenager in Love, and His Latest Flame. On the next Fresh Air, music critic Peter Guralnick remembers the late songwriter, and we talk with singer Johnny Adams about his new recording of recent songs by Doc Pomus. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.